Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So she became his wife, and he loved her. Words from Genesis chapter 24, verse 67. This is the last in a four-part mini-series on marriage, both within us and the Lord, and our marriages with one another. It's based, of course, on the story of Genesis 24 of Isaac and Rebekah. So far in the story, the servant of Abraham, his head servant, has been sent on a mission by Abraham to find a wife for his son Isaac from Abraham's own clan, who had stayed back in Haran when Abraham continued on toward the Holy Land. The servant has carried out this mission. He has gone to Haran. He has met Rebekah at the well and met her family, and now they have given her consent. And in our story today, it is the next morning after the servant and his men have arrived, and he is saying to his hosts, "Send me on my way with the young woman, with Rebekah." Now, her brother and her mother are understandably a little bit reluctant to have her go right away. Remember, there were no phones in those days, so Abraham's servant didn't call ahead and say, "Hey, I'm coming for your daughter. Get her ready and prepare yourself." Rebekah and her family had been living along very peacefully, not bothering anybody, I guess, and all of a sudden these guys show up from who knows where and say, "We want to take your daughter." Well, I think any one of us, knowing that we would likely not see her for quite a long time, would maybe want a little bit more time to say goodbye. So it was a very reasonable request. Let her stay here for another week or 10 days, and then you can take her and go. But this servant was nothing if not a single-minded fellow. He was on a mission, and he was going to carry it out, and he says, "Please, now that the Lord has given me success, let me take her and go so that I may bring her back to my master, and she may be married to Isaac." Well, I guess they figured that maybe they could pass the buck a little bit, or maybe they figured they should actually ask Rebekah after talking all around her. Maybe she herself should have something to say about whether she would go or not. So they say, "Let's call her and ask her what she wishes to do." And they ask Rebekah, and she says she will go. And this once again shows the character of Rebekah. She was not one to hold back. She was somebody who was completely in to whatever she was doing. And later in the story, we find that she was, if anything, more than a match for Isaac. So Rebekah, having never met these people before the day before, says, "I will go with them." And she does. And she and her maids, her nurse and her maids, return with Abraham's servant and his men back to the land of Canaan, to Palestine. And they went all the way down to the southern area where Isaac was living. And the way the story is told, it makes us wonder whether Abraham had already moved away, because although it was Abraham sending his servant on the journey, when the servant returned, it was to Isaac. So where was Abraham? We don't exactly know, but we do know that Abraham later on took another wife. And so perhaps Abraham had already departed, knowing that his work was finished. His work with Isaac was finished, and now it was time for Isaac to go on as the head of the household. So as the servant brings Rebekah back, it's a beautiful story. It's told in such understated terms. Isaac is out meditating in the field. Isaac is a thoughtful man, and he is out in the field, perhaps communing with God, perhaps communing with his thoughts. And he looks up and sees a caravan of camels approaching, and probably recognizes them. And then we see the other side, Rebekah on her camel, looking and seeing this man walking toward her, and I think she knows in her heart who it is as well. She gets down from her camel and asks the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field toward us?" And he, of course, says, "That is my master." Again, the transition from Abraham to Isaac is taking place. Before Abraham was his master, now Isaac is his master. And so Rebekah takes her veil and covers herself the way that a chaste woman would in those days when coming upon the man that she was to marry. So Isaac takes Rebekah into his mother Sarah's tent, And remember, Sarah had died before all of this took place. And there Isaac marries Rebekah, and it says that he loved her, and that it comforted him after his mother's death. So this is, in a sense, the conclusion of this beautiful story of love, of really love at first sight in many ways. And yet we know that marriage is really not the ending. Marriage is the beginning. And we'll talk about that a little more in a minute. Marriage is a process of becoming one. In fairy tales, once the hero and the heroine get married, that's the end of the story. They live happily ever after. Wouldn't it be wonderful? In real life, marriage is, as I just said, just the beginning. Courtship, when we're finding that person and we're attracted to them, speaking to them, making the proposals, all of this up to the point of marriage is really only the process of being in the womb before we come to birth. That is the very beginnings when the relationship is first being formed. And when we get married, we can think of that as the birth, not the end, but the birth of the marriage. That is when we begin our married life together. And we don't automatically become one in spirit just because the minister has pronounced that you are husband and wife. Rather, we start a long process of becoming one if we are truly one within our hearts and minds. So marriage is a relationship in which we become one inside ourselves and with our partners. And we've been talking about both levels as we go along. In fact, all three levels, the Lord's process of becoming one inside himself, our process of becoming one, our head and our heart, and the way we become one with our marital partner. Those of us who have been married or been in a close relationship with someone else know that over time we come to know and to love our partner or our close friend in a way that we haven't been able to at first. We come to know them on a deeper and deeper level. It's like the proverbial artichoke where you peel away the layers one after another, moving toward the heart. At first, we know quite a bit about our partner, but as the years and the decades go by, we get to know them more intimately and more deeply, and we can become one with them at a deeper level than we were even capable of earlier on. Because the other thing that's happening, two things come to mind right away. One is that as we see who our partner is, we begin to, in psychological terms, internalize the characteristics of the other. And in more practical terms, we come to know the things that our partner knows and to love the things that our partner loves. So we bring something of our partner, of our married partner, into ourselves, and we become more like them in our heart, in our spirit. And the other thing that happens is as we live together with this person we are very close to, we go through an internal process of becoming more one in ourselves, in our heart, in our mind. We rub edges against one another. We find out where our feelings and our thoughts are not congruent with each other, where what we say and what we do don't quite match up. And marital partners are fairly good at showing us where we have a little bit of work to do. So we also become more one within ourselves as we have this close relationship with the other person. Out in the world, it's pretty easy to keep a mask on and to not show what we're really like inside, or at least not show our deepest thoughts and feelings. But it doesn't take long living with another person before those masks come off, and the other person knows exactly what's inside of us, even if we try to pretend that they don't. And so in that close relationship with another person, we find out things about ourselves that we didn't know before, and we face them, and we are able to work on that inner marriage, putting what we love deepest within our hearts together with our thoughts, and getting ourselves to be a person who acts from the heart, also with intelligence and thoughtfulness. So we have this process of becoming one within ourselves, and also becoming more and more one with our partner at a deeper and deeper level. And so in heaven, Swedenborg tells us, a married pair are not called two angels. Here we see ourselves as physical bodies, and we tend to think of two people as being two. Yet in heaven, married partners have reached some such oneness that angels call them one angel, not two angels. So they do become one, even though still they have their own presence. And yet, when you see a married partner in heaven, you can see that they are really one in spirit, even though they show two faces, the face of a man and a woman. And Swedenborg gives a little bit more description of this oneness that takes place. This is a quote from Swedenborg's book on marriage that we read in our marriage service here at the church. He described marriage love as a union of souls and a bonding of minds, creating a bond in the hearts, and therefore in the flesh. Its everlasting joys are interdependence, peace, tranquility, unreserved trust, inmost friendship, and a mutual desire of mind and heart to be of every possible service to one another. This is perhaps not the beginning of marriage, but this is our goal in marriage, to find that kind of oneness, that kind of interdependence and peace and tranquility, and that heartfelt desire to be of every service, of every good to one another. It's something that we don't immediately achieve, but something that we work for throughout our lives, and that is whether we are married here on earth or not. Because as I've said before, marriage is something that takes place inside of us, and if it does, whether or not we find our partner here on earth, the Lord does have someone waiting for us to spend eternity with. So this is something for all of us to hope, to aspire, and to work for. Now, we've already talked some about the marriage within ourselves and also in the Lord. We know that our process is parallel to the Lord's process. The Lord showed us the way in his outward life, but also in his inward life, in what he went through. And we will never achieve the completeness, the fullness that he did. And yet we can always be working toward that oneness with God that he fully achieved. The Lord Jesus in his life on earth was moving toward a full union, toward a seamless flow from his divine heart, the infinite divine love, through his divine mind, that divine rationality that we've been talking about, into his words and actions. And if we watch him in action in the gospel story, we see that there is no hesitation in his words. He acts immediately from the heart, but also with great intelligence and with great wisdom. We see that seamless flowing of a mind that is one within itself. We also see, I should say, at some times where he struggles. And it was not even until the final end of his life, till after his crucifixion, until the resurrection, that he truly achieved that full oneness. And yet we can see it illustrated and shown in his life, in many parts of his interactions with the people, with the scribes and Pharisees, and with especially his closest disciples. Now we are also moving toward this oneness as well, and it does take us a lifetime to achieve whatever oneness we are able to within ourselves. Swedenborg gives the example of learning to walk, and I think it's very helpful to see concrete examples of what it is like that we do inside, because it's hard for us to conceive of the things inside of ourselves. It seems abstract and intellectual, and yet it all works out through correspondences to be shown in our outward actions as well. Now, when we are very young and we're learning to walk, it's hard work. You see those little kids, 1 year old or so, and boy, oh boy, are they determined. They're going to get up and they're going to walk, and it doesn't matter how many times they fall over, they're going to keep on trying it out. And they're going to keep working at it until they're finally able to walk. And at first it takes all of their concentration. You've probably seen the little children, they're just toddlers, just learning to walk, and they're doing fine, and then somebody says something to them, they look up and boom, over they go. Because they don't have enough to be able to think about walking and paying attention to somebody talking to them at the same time. So early on, walking and chewing gum at the same time is indeed very difficult. But as we move along, it gets to be second nature. Pretty soon, we don't even think about it. How many of us, unless we've recently had a stroke or an accident, how many of us, as we're walking down the road, think, now let's see, first I have to put this foot forward, then I have to put that foot forward. We don't think about that anymore. We just walk, because now it has become, as Swedenborg says, part of our almost innate nature. It's become right a part of our disposition, of our character. We don't have to think about it anymore because it's become a part of us. And this is what Swedenborg is talking about when he talks about truth moving from our material level, from the level of our thinking external mind, into our inner self. That when the truth moves into our inner self, it becomes part of us, and we no longer even have to think about it. We just act on it. And all of us have different experiences of this. We've gone through many of us having children and having to figure out how to raise the children. We've gone into careers and having to learn that work. It also works in our inner life. Whenever we start a new thing, it's always a challenge. We always have to think about it and try hard and work at it. And over time, we become good at it through habit, and it becomes second nature. It's the same way with our inner spiritual life. Whenever we start a new phase of our inner life, we have to work at it. We have to try hard, and it seems very difficult, and we say, I can never do this. The other day, my son Chris was practicing his guitar, and for some reason he's got a mental block about playing chords on the guitar. He's really very good, and his guitar teacher is very happy with his progress, and yet he's got this thing about chords. I can't do it, I can't do it. Well, we say, yes, you can, of course you can. And if you're not going to do it, you might as well not take guitar lessons because you're not going to be able to play guitar if you don't play chords. I can't do it. I can't do it. Well, I go upstairs, and then I hear these chords coming from downstairs. Gee whiz, he can do it after all. It wasn't that he couldn't do it. It's that it was a struggle for him, and he didn't really want to. And that's the same way it is for us when we turn over a new leaf. It's a struggle, and we don't really want to. And yet, if we persist, we can make it through, and we can get to the point where that thing that seems so hard at first, speaking a nice word instead of a nasty word, doing something like the dishes for our wife or husband when we'd rather not, going the extra mile in anything, at first it seems so hard, and yet later on, as we become used to it, it just becomes a part of who we are, and we have now built that right into our character. So we get married after we've gone through the struggle, after our head and heart have gotten to the point where they work together and where we are at one within ourselves, both loving and knowing and doing the thing that we wanted originally. So we do have this process of becoming married within ourselves, and it's a lifetime process. We go through it over and over again in little ways, and in our whole lifetime we go through a process of gradually bringing our heart and our head together around the love of God and the love of one another. And this is what Jesus is talking about also in our New Testament reading. When we bring our love into action, when we show our light in our actions, that is when our light is not hidden under a bowl, but is out on that candlestick. We let our light of truth shine when we put it on the stand of good deeds. We think truth is all about talking, but really truth is about acting. Truth is about guiding us in the right way in our lives. And when we, in our actions toward everyone around us, our spouse, our family, our friends, our co-workers, when we are letting what we know guide our actions, especially what we know spiritually, the golden rule, the two great commandments, when those are coming out into our actions, even if it's hard at first, the more we do it, the more that light shines out, so that our heart and our head are one, and they are working through our hands. And then, as Jesus says, our light will shine before people so that they may see our good deeds and praise our Father in heaven. Amen.